14 years after losing virtually all control over her life, and one day before her case goes back before the judge, Britney Spears picks up a powerful ally in her quest to live like an adult. The American Civil Liberties Union is weighing in and speaking out. And later on, make it work. That is pretty much great advice for anything. It is superb advice if you're trying to please Tim Gunn, the master of fashion competition television, on a brand new season of a show that literally turns rags into riches. It's all tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. Tomorrow in Los Angeles, the judge overseeing Britney Spears' now 13-year-long conservatorship is going to take up some motions that just might tinker with the terms, though probably not grant the still famous, still working, still high-earning pop star the freedom that she so desperately wants. But one thing has changed since the hearing 3 weeks ago in which Spears called her situation abusive and pleaded for the freedom to make her own decisions. That thing that changed is she now has the ACLU on her side, publicly and officially. And that is news, and it is a really big deal. That's not legal speak. That's just what it is. Joining me to talk about these implications, the fallout, and the jaw-dropping stakes are Diane Diamond, who's an investigative journalist. Her book on guardianships and everything that can and does go wrong is in the works. And I'd also like to welcome Troy Martin. He is a lawyer specializing in probate cases and dependent adults. Welcome to the both of you, and thank you for being here. Troy, let me begin with you. Just how big a deal is this that the ACLU and, oh, I don't know, 27 other friends of the brief have signed on to this case?
I think this is a very interesting development, and it's quite extraordinary because you don't often get amicus briefs in superior court proceedings like this. They are bringing about some ideas, which I think it's a long time in coming, that are discussed in conservatorship proceedings. This idea that a conservatee should be allowed to give as much feedback and have as much input into their lives as they are capable of doing. And they're throwing around a term which we don't hear a lot here in California, which is supported decision making, which is basically maybe a path that Britney might have to take more control over her life and to eventually terminate these proceedings.
So, Diane Diamond, you have been researching this for years. You have literally been diving into the conservatorship, mystery, for lack of a better term, guardianship in other states. Mm-hmm. And what you have determined, as I understand it, in your writings, is that it is next to impossible for anyone to get out of this thing. But this is Britney Spears. This is public. This is on television. And it might be different. Am I wrong?
Well, no, you're not wrong. And I, you know, as painful as it's been for Britney Spears, I thank her for having the courage to come out and really bring this issue to the forefront. Conservatorship, it's called guardianship in most other states, but in California, that's what they call it. And it is like, to use an old phrase, like a tar baby. You know, you can't hardly get out of a guardianship once it is put into place. Why? Well, because a judge approves it. The judge appoints a lawyer, appoints a court visitor, appoints a guardian, appoints all these people. And then for them later to go back and say, oh, gosh, I appointed the wrong people, or I shouldn't have started that in the first place, or, yeah, this person doesn't need to be in guardianship anymore. Well, judges are reluctant to do that. You know, they don't want to admit that they may have made a mistake or appointed a greedy or heartless guardian, for example. So, again, I appreciate that she has come forward. I appreciate that the ACLU is involved. But I got to tell you, Ashley, I have been covering this since 2015, and I know people in Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Maine, Michigan, Oregon, California, Texas, New Mexico, who begged the ACLU to get involved, and they never did. So I'm glad to see they're interested now, and all those other groups.
I'll tell you what. So I got the brief here. Just hold it up so everybody can see it. It is not small. It's 60 or 76 pages. Takes a lot of reading to get through it. But when you do get through it, there are two essential questions. And Troy, as the lawyer, I might ask this to you. Effectively, what they're saying is they want to allow Brittany to choose her own attorney because her current attorney is stepping down. And then they also want her to be given access. And this is key. To assistance and tools to make her selection. And I think that's what you meant by supported decision making. So with those two very simple boiled down concepts from a very, very big brief, what are the odds she's going to get what she wants?
Well, given the public nature of these proceedings, which is highly unusual because generally conservatorship proceedings are deemed to be private and they're not playing out on such a large stage, I think she's got a pretty good possibility, especially since we have an interesting dynamic working between the conservators here. Jody Montgomery is positioning herself to sort of be the champion for Brittany's rights. And one of the things that she is suggesting is sort of a happy medium, a go-between between allowing Brittany to have complete free reign in choosing who she wants and doing something that's more supported. She has actually filed a petition, she being Jody Montgomery, to appoint a guardian ad litem, not to make the decision for Brittany, but to help guide her in the decision so that we can make sure that Brittany is making a good decision with all the available information. It's also, I think, very crucial that she be given greater access, the ability to have her cell phone. Some of the reports that I've read say that she hasn't been allowed to have a cell phone, and people have had to sneak her burner phones so that she can contact people. You can't have, and I think the ACLU sets this forth very clearly in their brief, you can't have the effective assistance of counsel if you don't have the free ability to communicate with them. And I think a lot of those things the court is going to put into place in a structured way to make sure that Brittany is able to make these decisions.
You know, Diane, when I see these pictures of this extraordinary performer, I'm also mindful of other extraordinary public citizens who've had big public meltdowns in their life, like, you know, Anne Heche and Charlie Sheen, and they weren't placed under these restrictions. And understandably, I think it's fair to say without libel that they were, you know, in full downward spiral. So let's just say, because we don't know Brittany's medical file and we shouldn't, she is troubled. And let's just say she has a lot of mental illness. What level should it be for that conservatorship to be there for good? For the good of her.
Yeah. You know, I've done a lot of reporting on the negative side of guardianship, and I could go on for hours about that, Ashley. You know me well enough to know that. But guardianship can be a good thing. Guardianship has helped a lot of people who cannot manage their lives. If they have a loved one is the guardian or a trusted person is a guardian, there's a lot of for-profit guardians who are really devoted and do wonderful things. But then there are the countless heartless, greedy ones, and that's the big problem. You know, if I could just go off what Troy said, I think maybe, just maybe, this judge may give Brittany a break in that she might restore the telephone, but I think she might give her own choice for attorney. And as I understand it, there's a man named Matthew Rosengart in L.A. there. This guy is described as a pit bull street fighter, a guy with a big brain and even bigger principles. You see, he's a litigator. Most of the people that are appointed by judges for people like Britney Spears are elder law attorneys or estate attorneys. This guy, if the judge approves, is a litigator, and he's going to do whatever his client wants. He's going to fight and fight and fight. No one has fought for Britney within this sphere,
and we should say about him,
their fees would stop.
He's not a small deal. He's got, like, Steven Spielberg as a client, Ben Affleck, Sean Penn. So he's not a small potato. And obviously he has some credibility, too, because we know there are some lawyers out there who are not particularly credible and might have leached onto Brittany. And, you know, I do want to do one thing. And you were just seeing some video. I want to let our audience know. Those are the Instagram videos that Brittany often releases. And those are the most recent ones within the last 2 days. And they are very representative of what she does all the time on her Instagram. If you follow her, she spins and spins and spins and dances in these little sort of half-see shirts and tiny boy shorts a lot, like a lot. This is kind of a repetitive post. It looks very similar all the time. But now I want to show you something that I found in those 76 pages. It was a supporting document, and they were screen grabs of her texts. So they may have not placed them in order, and it's very hard to tell from reading them whether they are in order. But let me start from how they appeared in order in the brief. In order for me to stay and help support you, I must be sure to stay in my lane. Getting you a new attorney by filing with the court is the best legal approach. Your dad has excellent attorneys, and you should too. Now, right now, we are not supposed to know who this is because it says Jane Doe, but I'm going to let you know I think we do know who it is. And then Brittany supposedly answers, I know, but I want redacted. And I get a new lawyer. I can do both. And then Jane Doe responds, your new lawyer will do that. Redacted, redacted. Brittany responds, okay. Next page. Redacted, redacted, redacted. And then I need you to stay as my co-conservator of person. I'm asking you for your assistance in getting a new attorney. Redacted. Brittany says, thank you for your help. Next page, and we're going to get the big clue that she's talking to Jody Montgomery, her co-conservator, her conservator of person. This person, Jane Doe, says, you must have your own representation and we will clear the way in court. Redacted. Redacted. Then Brittany says, it's not cool, though. You're not giving me names, Jody. There's the Jody. Redacted. Then Brittany, I don't have representation, though. Then Jody presumably says, Sam is still your attorney until the court releases him. And tomorrow we do expect, I think, Troy, we do expect the request that she's making, which is that Sam is making. He wants off the case. He's been her attorney. He wants to be let go. Bessemer Trust, that's been managing her money, they want out. If I'm correct, I think you think that's going to happen, right?
I think it's likely to happen. The court is not interested in some involuntary servitude for Sam Ingham here. What might happen is that the court appoints another person off of the volunteer panel, sort of as a placeholder, until these proceedings play out and it's determined whether Brittany has the ability to appoint her own attorney.
And Diane, I'm going to get your thoughts in just a second on those texts, because I heard you oohing and aahing like this was informative. These this just came out, so maybe they haven't been seen before. After the break, I want you to weigh in on what those redactions might or might not tell you. And then we're also going to be joined by an attorney who has autism and who at one point could not speak, but now says she speaks for those who are disabled and that they have rights. She believes that Brittany has a disability and has these rights. So we're coming back on this topic in a moment. Welcome back. We are looking ahead to the next court hearing in the Free Brittany saga and the impact of her brand new powerful allies in the ACLU. My guests are journalist Diane Diamond, attorney Troy Martin, and I'm very pleased to welcome to our conversation Haley Moss. She is an attorney and a disability rights advocate. She recently penned a piece for Teen Vogue entitled Britney Spears' Conservatorship is a Disability Rights Issue that Deserves More Attention. Welcome to you, Haley, and I want to get to that topic in 1 minute, but not before I hear Diane Diamond's response to those text messages that were just released in that amicus brief. What were your thoughts when you heard those, Diane?
Well, if Jody Montgomery is really in league now with Brittany and is going to also suggest to the court that Brittany get her own attorney, I think there's a real good chance of that happening. I also think maybe that the judge will ease up a little bit, give Brittany a little bit more freedom with her finances, with her personal decision making, and then watch that. See how that goes. See if these baby steps lead to the end of this conservatorship. I see some real movement coming on this pretty quick.
So, Haley Moss, I read your piece in Teen Vogue, and it was great. I was also fascinated about your own personal story that, you know, you grew up and you were nonverbal, and that thank God you had these incredibly supportive parents, or you yourself might have ended up in a conservatorship. As you look at the Brittany case, though, is there, as a lawyer, a case to be made where we do not know her medical story? We do not know the dozens of assessments that dispassionate parties have been brought in by the court to make and have only reported to the judge. A judge has just said in the last 2 weeks, Haley, she's not capable of protecting herself from the vultures who could come in and take advantage of her. So with that idea, is it possible that the Free Britney folks don't have it right?
I'm not 100% sure if it's that the Free Britney folks don't have it right so much as we really don't know. But you have to understand, the judge essentially deemed her disabled. There's been lots of talk following what happened over a decade ago with Britney having a very public mental health episode, and multiple episodes for that matter, that she is essentially disabled in some way, shape, or form. So it's been rumored that she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and other related mental health conditions, all of which are considered disabilities. So it's really important to understand that what happens to Britney is essentially because she is seen as a person with a disability. That is who often gets placed within guardianships and conservatorships, is people with disabilities, primarily people who have disabilities related to age, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities like myself, and people with mental health or psychiatric disabilities, which is the category Britney falls under.
So I read a lot about autonomy and agency in these briefs and in a lot of reporting about the process she's about to go into tomorrow. I don't know if people are going to have to go through throngs of protesters, but people in L.A. and New York are planning to gather at the courthouse and in New York City for, you know, rallies to free Britney. But, Troy, the autonomy and agency is an important argument. Agency in particular. What if Britney Spears does not have the personal agency to protect herself? How are we to judge from the outside what many others who are in the inside have all said, have agreed she does not?
Well, one of the interesting things about what Britney had to say in her presentation a couple of weeks ago was she repeatedly said that she does not want to be evaluated. And I think that's a concession on her part that she doesn't feel like she can handle things on her own. And getting back to Jody Montgomery and her being the individual that was involved in those text messages, very early on, after Britney spoke to everybody at the hearing, Jody came forward and said, I have a plan. I'm working on a plan to slowly give Britney more and more autonomy so that eventually, not now, not what everybody's calling for in the Free Britney movement, but over a period of time, she can become more and more responsible for making her own decisions, and eventually the conservatorship will be terminated. And I think that approach is going to be very attractive to the court, because I don't think the court wants to admit that, and I don't think it was a mistake at the very beginning for this conservatorship to be put in place, because what was going on in the time was very scary for Britney. But it could very well be that the conservatorship has served its purpose and that there is going to be this slow weaning off process where Britney is able to control her earnings. And by the way, that's one thing I have not seen mentioned in the press at all. In California, there's actually a statute on the books. It's little known because this rarely happens in the context of a conservatorship. But if a person in a conservatorship is well enough to work, they have the right to control their wages and their earnings, not the conservator. The statute actually says this is not a part of the conservatorship estate. So when Britney goes to a residency in Las Vegas, or she is a judge on the X Factor making $15 million, she probably should be controlling that money and not her father.
It is hard to believe that she has done the amount of work that she's done, but can't, you know, see the doctor she wants. So to that end, Haley Moss, wrap it up for me. I only have about 40 seconds, but do you think that Britney Spears is going to get some kind of, as you call it, supported decision making instead of this full on conservatorship?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Britney is 100% entitled to that. Britney is entitled to the ability to make her own decisions. And what's really important about supported decision making is that it's seen as a less restrictive alternative to guardianship. So essentially, Britney can make her own decisions with the help of people she trusts. But at the end of the day, it's her decision what she does. And giving Britney the option to use supported decision making or have a less restrictive alternative in place is really a win for disability rights as a whole, not just Britney Spears, but for all disabled people and the estimated 1.5 million disabled people that are under guardianship or conservatorship today. Yeah. And that number might actually be greater. So I think we have to see this much bigger picture.
I just wish a lot of those Free Britney people who take to the streets and the internet were there 15 years ago while everybody was just feeding off of her and her plight. So it's, I find the whole thing completely tragic. But listen, thank you, Diane, Troy, and Haley. I appreciate all three of you and your insight. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Coming up straight ahead, yes, Bill Cosby's a free man. And yes, he's now happy to celebrate his 84th birthday. But the man beside him who does his PR says he's not done with us. He is going back to Pennsylvania to say, you owe me money for putting me away. And there may be even more to that. I'm going to ask how much more. How much more does Bill Cosby want after the ordeal he's been through? We'll ask that next. Welcome back. It turns out the Pennsylvania court ruling that opened the prison cell door for Bill Cosby may have opened other doors, too. To a late-in-life reprisal of his stand-up career, perhaps, and maybe to some hefty compensation for the nearly 3 years that he spent locked up after a jury found him guilty of sexual improprieties. And for that, he would need the help of another jury in a future trial. And you know who would pay if he won. More than likely not the insurance companies, it would be the taxpayers. Much of what we know about the former superstar's post-prison life and plans comes from my next guest, Andrew Wyatt. He is Bill Cosby's publicist and spokesperson. Andrew, thank you for coming on. You have stood by Bill Cosby's side. That was you we just saw on the day that Bill Cosby was released. I think a big question a lot of people want to know right now is, how much is Bill Cosby going to sue the state of Pennsylvania for?
We feel that he's owed a lot of money. And first, thank you for having me. Mr. Cosby was given an unwanted 2-year, 10-month vacation that he never asked for. His constitutional rights were abolished and his due process was stripped away from him. Just in 2016, Governor Tom Wolf, the governor of Pennsylvania, put into law that anybody who's sentence was vacated or they were found to be imprisoned falsely, that they should get $50,000 for every year that they spent. Look, this man was stripped of his dignity, his reputation, his name because of a corrupt judge and an overzealous and corrupt district attorney who was using Bill Cosby for his political aspirations. If you remember, he ran a Willie Horton-style campaign ad saying, if you elect me, I will bring Bill Cosby to justice. So he's due millions and millions of dollars. And as Mr. Cosby has said to me today, he said, I feel that this district attorney and Judge Stephen T. O'Neill and Kevin Steele should resign effective immediately.
So, Andrew, millions and millions is a big number. Do you have an actual number?
Don't have an actual number. I know that we're looking into different routes on what type of legal action that can be taken against Montgomery County. Look, Ashley, you're an attorney. You have two essential tools of the Constitution. That's the 5th and 14th Amendment that protects the powerless, whether rich or poor, from being abused by the powerful, those who are the gatekeepers of the judicial system. Mr. Cosby was stripped of all those rights. He should have never been brought, charged or brought to trial. Look, he was given a deal. He had immunity. And this became one of the greatest victories in the history of jurisprudence. And what those justices did for us not just for Mr. Cosby, it was way bigger than him, for every American in this United States. And what they tried to say that Mr. Cosby was not an American. And this is a man who served in the Navy for 4 years. He should have never been brought there. But this was just a district attorney who overstepped his boundaries to get a conviction.
So, Andrew, I am super curious when you say millions and millions, because that would require a lawsuit that would be defamation or libel, given that, you know, his livelihood might suffer, given the guilty verdict and then the overturning, et cetera. But that said, there is this nattering little thing that Mr. Cosby himself said. You said he was stripped of the dignity by the state, but he may have done it himself in that statement. And I know it hurts to hear this, but he said in the deposition to the question, when you got the Quaaludes, was it in your mind that you were going to use the Quaaludes for young women that you wanted to have sex with? And he answered yes. So do you think you can win something? I have just about a minute left. Do you think you can win something, given that those are Cosby's words, and that might be the reason that he might not get gigs and, you know, earn millions?
But Ashley, let me say this to you. You didn't read his full context of the conversation. What they asked him, they were talking about the culture of the 70s. Did you have Quaaludes in that culture? He said young people love to party with them. Yes. And did you give them to women without their consent? No. He gave them to women when they asked him for the Quaaludes.
Oh, no, he didn't answer no. No, he was stopped by his attorney, because no, that was the next question, which I think is important.
Yeah. We read the deposition, but he talked about the culture in the 70s, which they were called disco biscuits. Now, my thing is that for you and the media, we ask that you vet the women who made those claims. They have not been vetted. And if they went to a detective and made any claims, they would have been vetted. And no one has vetted
the women. I have to leave it there only because I have a bunch of guests coming up. Andrew White, thank you. And thank you for the promotion. I'm not an attorney. I just play one on TV. But thank you, Andrew. I appreciate it.
You gave the Britney Spears deal 4 minutes, and you should have given me the same amount.
And we have another guest coming ahead. And thank you, Andrew. We appreciate you coming on. Still ahead, if you wear your jammies on Zoom calls, Tim Gunn says he sees all. He's next. Welcome back. If you can inspire a generation of fashion designers, or really anybody for that matter, with just three little words, you may just be a superhero. Like, take for instance, Tim Gunn, with the standing orders to make it work and his own inscrutable sense of style. Tim Gunn has made hundreds of careers, millions of fans, and 2 decades of awesome TV. First on Project Runway, and now on the Amazon original series Making the Cut, which, by the way, season 2 premieres this Friday. And I said yes. Gunn is still paired with BFF Heidi Klum. I was not kidding about the superhero part. Marvel Comics bestowed that honor a few years back, and I won't ask whether Tim actually posed in the Iron Man suit or if that was just a paint on. I'm going to ask him a lot of other nosy questions, though. Tim Gunn, what a treat. How are you?
Ashley, thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm wonderful. I'm better for being with you.
Look at you. So here's what I want to know. How is it that you are so, you know, direct and to the point and sometimes scathing to the people who you're counseling, and yet they love it, we love it, it works, and your advice is really, honestly, never wrong?
Well, you flatter me again. I have to tell you, Ashley, I honed this ability over the course of many years of teaching. I was in a classroom for 29 years, and I learned very quickly that if you are perceived to be too harsh, too blunt an instrument, your students discredit you. They just shut you down, and you can't get back in again. So I've learned how to tell the truth, but how to be empathetic in that regard. I play the words in my own head before I say them, and I think about the intonation and the tone, because I want to be heard. I want people to listen to what I do have to say. They can reject it, but I at least want them to take it in. So it's been a long time.
You know, I was an early adopter of Project Runway when it started. And I remember back then thinking like, oh, that make it work thing is just delish. And I wondered if you had actually thought it through, planned it out, or if it was just always part of your DNA, which just came into the show and it worked.
It was definitely part of my DNA. I began saying in my classrooms at Parsons a couple decades ago, and it came about because I had a student, a senior, who was working on a project, and this was a two-semester class, so it was 30 weeks. And we were about 20 weeks into these 30 weeks, and she decided she was going to scrap her entire project and start over again. She didn't like it anymore. And I said, you're not doing anything of the kind. You're going to sit with this project. You're going to offer up a diagnosis of what's wrong and a prescription for how to make it work. And that was the first time that I used it. It was very helpful, and it helped her succeed. Because if you just abandon something that's not going well and you start it up fresh anew and it's a great success, what have you actually learned? I mean, what you've learned is let's abandon everything that troubles us, and that's just not the way to navigate life. So I really do believe in make it work, and I say it to myself almost every day.
It's a good mantra to have, honestly. You know, did you ever think when you got into the business of, you know, plying your trade on TV, that people would be interested in how, you know, these things are made, that what the sausage making actually looks like?
Ashley, I never dreamed people would be interested. When we were taping season one, and season one, I was never intended to be on camera. I was a consultant to the show. And at the very last minute, in fact, 24 hours before the designers were arriving, the producer said, would you be willing to go in there and ask them what they're doing? And I said, well, it's what I do every day. So sure, it's how I've spent my life. But I never once dreamed that I would actually be in the cut of the show. I thought as long as they have the designers responding to me, no one needs to see me. No one needs to hear my voice. So no one has been more shocked by this phenomenon than I have, really.
And now you're like a machine. I mean, the product that you have put out there, and I don't just mean garments, I mean outfits and actual media. It's too long to actually list. You've got all these books, you've got all these shows, you know, obviously the latest of which is making the cut. But one thing is very consistent, apart from you, is Heidi Klum. So you guys, are you joined at the hip? Do you come as a package deal? Are you just BFFs and you want to work together forever and ever, amen? Or what's the connection?
Well, I have to say, we really do have a kind of a pinky pack between us about only doing projects together that pertain to fashion competitions in particular. And I will also tell you, she and I and our incredible executive producer, Sarah Ray, have had a vision about what has become Making the Cut. We've had this vision for, well, many prior seasons of Project Runway, but because of the success of Runway, no one would let us tamper with the format. And once we had the opportunity to move on without Runway and pitch this show, our dream was to be in partnership with Amazon. For two reasons. One, because of their original series, Crime Video, but the other because of Amazon Fashion. Because the whole notion of being able to see a winning garment on the runway and buy it that very same moment was something we thought only Amazon can achieve. So when we ended up having this wonderfully synergistic relationship and they said, yeah, we want to do this, I still pinch myself. I still can't believe that this isn't all a dream, but it's real. So Heidi and I have 17 years together, and I hope we have 17 more.
Yeah, me too. I really enjoy watching you guys together, and I like the shows. I'm not even much into fashion. I'm pretty boring, as you can see. But I do like the industry, and like I said before, the sausage making. Then I saw this from you, and I loved you all over again. 2016, you wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post, and you were basically blasting designers for, you know, ignoring everybody who is over a size 12. Let me just read a little bit. You said that they are dripping with disdain, lacking imagination, or simply too cowardly to take a risk. So, I was in Target the other day looking for bathing suits, and I noticed all of the mannequins now are every size. There's a plus size mannequin next to a normal size mannequin next to a skinny mini, but that's Target. So Target's making headway, and online, their pictures of bikini models are all sizes as well. What about the rest of the industry?
Well, the industry is catching up. There still are pockets of it that ignore the fact that women come in all different sizes and shapes. But more and more people are coming to terms with the fact that this is a powerful and very large assemblage of buyers, particularly in this nation, where I hate to say it, but more than 60% of adult women are larger than a size 12. So to turn your back on this population is, first of all, it's foolish financially, but also what bigger thrill is there than to lift someone's spirit by helping them dress the way that they want to dress and looking fabulous? I mean, I just think it's the greatest thrill in the world.
Yeah, I agree. I've always been sort of mystified by the decision to ignore the largest market. You know, wow, there's a lot of money there. That's just dumb. Anyway, I like the way clothes look on a hanger, and maybe that's the way people like to fantasize about how the clothes might look on them. Tim, when we come back after the break, I have a couple of other questions for you, but I'm going to let you think about this one through the break. What article of clothing or fashion would you like to see go away forever and ever? And what item would you like to come back? We're still with Tim Gunn right after the break.
Given the appropriateness of the occasion, there is no better feeling for me than to go to a black tie event in a classic tuxedo. It's just, it's no fail. There are no risks involved. Every man looks great in a tux.
And every man looks great kissing Heidi Klum in a tux. I'm not surprised, Tim Gunn, that is your favorite go-to outfit. But I'd love to know what you really can't stand and what you'd like to see jettisoned from, you know, the whole zeitgeist of fashion.
Well, it's not that I actually want this item to disappear. It's that I want its original purpose to be reclaimed. And I'll state it by way of a question. Ashley, when did the legging become a pant? It's not a pant. It's an undergarment. It's meant to be worn with a tunic, for instance. And now it's paraded around as though it's trousers. It's preposterous. And you know for a fact that the first person who did this put them on in their home, walked by a mirror and said, I can't go outside wearing these. I look ridiculous. 20 minutes later, she walks by the mirror and she says, oh, it's not so bad. And 40 minutes later, she walks by and she says, I look hot. It's preposterous.
So this is the evolution of fashion. It's the people who take a few more, you know, second, third looks at the mirror. Okay, so what item of clothing would you like to see come back into our fashion practices?
Well, I will say this. I think if it's something that has gone away and hasn't come back, there's probably a very good reason for it. But what I'd like for people to rediscover, and I'd like it to become ubiquitous, is just a classic blazer or a jacket like I'm wearing in any color and any textile that suits your proclivities. Because there's no easier way to dress up a t-shirt and a pair of jeans than a blazer. It's so easy. And in the pre-pandemic days, I would say to people, have one on the back of your chair in your office. If the boss calls you in, it's a sign of respect and that you really care about your work and your peers.
I'm just so glad you didn't say corset, because that would have, you know, put a chasm between us, my friend. Okay, so speaking of pandemic, you just mentioned it. I had this thought that all of a sudden none of us were ever going to wear button pants again, but I wondered if you think that pandemic has had an impact on everything, including how we're going to present ourselves when we do leave the house.
Well, it certainly has had an impact on everything. That's for sure. It's even had a huge impact on my fashion. I used to express disdain for people who dress for comfort. It's like, it's not about comfort. It's about semiotics. It's about how the world perceives us. And if you want to dress to feel as though you never got out of bed, don't get out of bed. But after about 10 days in quarantine, and I was wearing my regular starchy clothes, I thought, this is ridiculous. But I went too far. I then started just wearing my pajamas all day, every day. And that was a mistake, too. So I found a happy medium, clothes with stretch. And I understand the comfort trap. I'm very empathetic now. But I do hope that people will enjoy dressing up again. Only recently I've been back in my suits, and I'm so happy to say that they still fit me, though I have to tug a bit. But it feels good. I just think we're much more aware of our place in the world when we feel that we look our best.
Yeah, I'm going to admit it, way too many meetings in pajama pants with a nice shirt, and that's just got to end. All of that has to end. So, okay, Tim, we do this thing with our guests. We seat you at a little cartoon table, and across the table from you, the chair is empty. You can fill that seat with anybody of your choosing, alive or no longer with us, but I'm dying to find out who you would like to have at your table for two.
Oh, my goodness, Ashley, I should have anticipated this. Wow. Oh, it's not that you're stumping me. I'm running all these names through my head. And they're all people who are no longer living.
I had guessed, honestly, that you'd pick Jackie O. That for some reason I thought, I bet he picks Jackie O for her fashion sense.
You know, I have great respect for Mrs. Onassis and of course for her style, but she was a rare hothouse flower, in a bell jar or in a vitrine. Unlike Mrs. Obama, who was equally as great a fashion icon, but so accessible and so relatable. And I'm proud to say I've had lunch with Mrs. Obama. So that is an achievement that I can check off. I'm going to say Gertrude Stein, the early 20th century writer and poet and playwright.
Gertrude Stein. Totally not what I expected. I thought maybe Versace too, but no. Okay, so Gertrude Stein. Any particular reason for that?
I'm a huge admirer of her work. And my favorite painting at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is known for all of its antiquities, my favorite painting is Picasso's portrait of Gertrude Stein from 1906. It moves me. And every time I'm at the museum, which is frequently, I pay it a visit. I pay it homage.
Well, that certainly gives me a window into your soul. And I would like to have a further window into your soul. I hope you'll join us again sometime, Tim. This has been delightful. Thank you for this.
Ashley, thank you. And I will join you anytime.
Yay! Okay, I just want to give a quick plug. Making the Cut Friday, this December, or this December, my goodness, I've jumped ahead. This July 16th, season 2 premieres. Thank you, Tim Gunn.
Thank you, Ashley.